Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
My takeaway when all of this was going on is that someone has information on our opponent. You know, things are going a million miles an hour. You know what it's like to be on a campaign. We just won Indiana, but we're talking about a contested convention. Things are going a million miles an hour again.
The sun also writhes. Donald Trump Jr. explains why he released emails confirming that he'd actually had the meetings with Russian contacts he'd previously denied having. My guests James Rogers and Michael Goldfarb will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the attempts by pro-Trump media to explain the latest developments, Macronism, and whether or not we yet understand what it is, and should America's big city mayors start acting more like presidents? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are James Rogers, Head of International Journalism Studies at City University here in London, and Michael Goldfarb, the journalist and broadcaster. Welcome both. We will start with further examination of what jurisprudence may come to know as the Trump Jr. defense, which is seeking to deny the thing you're accused of having done by defiantly producing evidence which confirms that you totally did it. Donald Trump Sr., rather, has described his son as open, transparent, and innocent, though this appears to be a minority view among a media and political establishment, once again pondering what may be the defining question of this American epoch. Are these people actively malevolent or just as dumb as a box of rocks? Michael, first of all, is there, just for fun, conceivably an innocent explanation for any of this?
No. The simple answer is no. And it is astonishing. When you get to the point where the sequence was the New York Times was going to publish these emails.
Indeed.
And had contact, I guess they must have contacted, giving them a final chance to comment. We've got the proof.
As you would.
And as they were presumably entering these emails into their content management system, Donald Trump Jr. decides to spike their guns. We'll get the New York Times, and I'll just release them on Twitter. That'll cost them, a million clicks, and it probably didn't. You know, it is phenomenal. It is not surprising. The connecting of dots on this is a process that takes place in real time. The denials can take place in their own space, and the idea that this would happen, that eventually we get to this point, was always there. And just to race ahead, because I noticed this morning, the Financial Times has a timeline. It costs money to look at the Financial Times. I pay for it. And the initial contact from this very odd British music promoter who lives in Moscow was on, I think, June 3rd or 4th of last year. And 3 days later or 4 days later, Donald Trump says, "You're going to be hearing some very interesting things soon." And if you can explain to me how Donald Trump knew we'd be hearing some interesting things about Hillary Clinton,
well,
3 days after his son was approached with the prospect of learning some interesting things about Hillary Clinton.
We also have to factor in the possibility that that was just yet another example of Donald Trump just saying things that came into his head. James, we've had 24 hours, or give or take, to absorb the implications of these emails. What do you make of them? I mean, I guess what I'm going to do at this point is impose my own increasingly solid-looking, I think, pet theory, which is that if it turns out that these people have broken all sorts of laws, it may just well be the case that they simply had no idea that they were doing it because they just don't have the first clue, well, really about anything, but certainly not about how this works. These are people who were learning about politics by running a presidential campaign.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it a lot myself in the last 24 hours, actually along the similar lines. I think here we're seeing an example of tactics which have worked very well in the United States and in some cases in international business applied to international diplomacy, where the rules are slightly different. Of course, there are some transferable skills, if you could use that phrase. But I think in a lot of cases, and I think I've been wondering in the last 24 hours if this shows that politicians, political leaders are in fact subject to even greater scrutiny than business leaders are. Business leaders are, of course, legitimate targets of media interest. I think politicians are quite rightly, the subject of even greater media scrutiny. So I think what's happening here is that the Trump family, Mr. Trump Jr. on this occasion, seems to have been trying to apply the tricks he might have learnt, for example, if he was bidding for a contract, something which he could then pull out. Legitimate too in political campaigns, but you've got to look out for the traps too, particularly for dealing with Russia. If you look at the Russian political history over the last 20 years, it's a story of the production at opportune moments of compromising material, kompromat as it's called in Russian. And in this case, it seems as if Mr. Trump Jr. went looking for some kompromat and may in fact himself have ended up being it.
Well, on that subject, Michael, and this is another a theory I'm trying on here. I've never in my time attempted to act as the go-between for a government attempting to undermine the democratic process of a country they perceive as an enemy. However, I'm reasonably sure that if I was going to do that, if I was going to act in the role that appears to have been occupied by this Rob Goldstone character, I would probably try to send emails that didn't literally spell the plot out right there. Is it possible that this whole thing is actually a setup by Russia? That it is a bear trap laid for Donald Trump Jr.?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think so. I think that what you have here is, going back to questions about, I think you insult rocks when you say dumb as a box of rocks. I'm going to advocate for rocks. You can meditate on them. I'm going to get Zen Buddhist theory out on you. Look. The thing you have to, I think people have to remember about the Trumps is, you know, they are, you know, garden variety rich people in America. I mean, Donald Trump was born on third base, as we say, and has tried to build a property empire, but mostly he's built a branding empire by being Donald Trump. And he plays a lot of golf. And in my time, I have been to golf clubs. I admit this. I don't play golf, but I've had a drink or two in them. And you will hear rich people say the most astoundingly stupid things, like, this is how you run a government. They have no idea how to run a government, a democratically elected government. They say, I would just do this. You just tell them to do it. And I do think that there's an element of that in the way they approach the doing the job. I mean, it's the way they approached running for office, and it's the way they approach it. But they're not very bright. They say, get there. Say, it really is hard. On your point, no, I don't think this is compromise. I mean, they are too stupid to understand that, you know, the objective is to get dirt. Well, everybody tries to get dirt on their opponents in political campaigns. And they didn't have the basic nous to know that if America's main adversary on the world stage comes to you with an offer, you go to the FBI or you just ignore it if it comes from, you know, some overweight music promoter that you met at a beauty contest in Russia. You know, they didn't have the nous to do that. I don't think there's compromise at this end. I really do not. I think they, you know, that Russia probably in a malevolent way knew they could manipulate this group of people. And, you know, what wouldn't surprise me, and this is highly speculative, none of the reporting puts it there, is if at some point in 2014 in Moscow, when he was doing the Miss Universe contest, some minion of Vladimir Putin whispered in his ear that you should run for president. This would work. You can make America a better place. They flattered his ego. And then later on, he made the decision. And they keep feeding him because it does work, actually, for Russia, for the U.S. to be in the position that it is now, isolated in the world. G19, not G20. So anyway, I mean, if there's a master planner, it would have to be the guy in the Kremlin. It surely isn't the guy elsewhere.
Well, I have long held myself that a tendency towards golf should be disqualification from high public office in itself. But on that note, we will move on slightly, because a key indicator of whether patience is wearing thin among the GOP establishment will be any change in tone among hitherto pro-Trump media. While there are many people more deserving of sympathy than staffers at an outlet like Breitbart, yesterday was a testing one for them. Shortly before Trump Jr. dumped the Russia emails on Twitter, Breitbart posted a defense doggedly insisting that the New York Times didn't have them and hadn't read them. James, the people who do work at places like Fox, Breitbart, even InfoWars, is there going to come a point at which even they start to feel like any defence they can make is so completely ridiculous that they do have to start thinking of their reputation beyond this?
Yes, I think will, because I think you see this in other branches of the media too, when you have a media owner who, and there's a big story which affects the media owner in which they're directly involved, and the media outlets might try to ignore it or be more circumspect about it for a certain time. One thinks in this country of the way the Murdoch papers treated the phone hacking scandal. There came a point eventually where they could no longer ignore it. They had to start running it because otherwise they were going to lose whatever credibility they might have had with their audiences. And even though it seems that the audiences for some of the alt-right media outlets, as they're called in the United States, may be a little more forgiving as far as credibility goes, I think that point will come too. So I think there is a point where they simply can't ignore it. However, simply, you know, shouting fake news and yelling all sorts of allegations at other people, those people making these often well-founded allegations, has worked reasonably well so far. So there's no reason why it can't continue for a while.
We'll come back to Murdoch shortly, who has proved fairly agile in leaping between, I don't know, is it horses in midstream? I think is probably the metaphor we're looking for. But when we think especially, Michael, of those really hardcore alt-right sites, your Breitbarts and InfoWars in particular, have they over-invested in Trump? Are they so completely wedded to him that if this whole project does implode, that they really don't have a role anymore?
Well, I think their role is overinflated, frankly, at the moment. Fox News, no. Fox News has a genuine constituency. I'm not sure how they'll roll with this. I mean, Breitbart is so closely connected to the Trump administration because Steve Bannon is you know, intimately connected with Breitbart. They are, it's political move. These aren't news outlets. They may be project into the core Trump support as being real news, but they're not. They're propaganda outfits, and I don't see them backing away any more than, you know, the Stürmer or the Berliner Beobachter in the mid-1920s backed away from the National Socialist Workers, German Workers' Party when Hitler was in jail. You know, they are committed to a certain worldview of America. If the Trumps were to go, it wouldn't change their view of what America should be, and they would simply look for a new figurehead. I mean, I think that's an important thing to remember. They irritate, and I mean, and the way sand irritates an oyster and it makes a pearl. Black pearl in this case, you know, they irritate the mainstream media and they get a lot more coverage because they say this stuff and it's so new and appalling in American society. I don't think so. I think they survive and they can shift their shapes pretty easily. I think the more interesting problem is the Republican Party itself. At what point? I mean, I'm not surprised
anymore.
Well,
we've asked that question many times.
You know, this is terribly disorienting. I grew up in the 1950s. I went to college and had friends whose parents' lives were ruined because they were blacklisted during the McCarthy era. You know, they weren't anywhere near being members of the Communist Party. They just, you know, used to drink coffee with people in 1939 who expressed sympathy for Stalin. And, you know, it's impossible to imagine the right-wing Republican Party today sitting still for someone who's basically been manipulated towards office by a former KGB officer.
James, is Fox News possibly the one to watch then? It doesn't have, people forget this about Fox, it doesn't have a massive audience, but it does, of course, have an influence beyond that audience in terms of determining the tone of debate. And obviously, when it is watched obsessively, as it clearly is, by the President of the United States, despite his denials as recently as today, it has an impact. But it is, of course, a it, it It's a Murdoch outlet. Murdoch historically does not like being associated with politicians or campaigns or ideas that he thinks are going down the gurgler. Mm. He has been extremely agile, certainly in this country, in leaping between parties as suits him. Is it possible that we might see Fox beginning, they wouldn't do it abruptly, one assumes, but beginning to turn its guns around?
Well, I think if the first signs of a move like that would be a sort of move to a more sort of critical friend stance, you know, in the sense of perhaps of the hope of shoring up Mr. Trump, offering him advice if they felt he was going substantially wrong. But you're right, Mr. Murdoch's media outlets and Mr. Murdoch himself have got an excellent track record, particularly in this country, of backing the winning team and of deciding before elections to support the party which eventually wins, the most recent one being something of a glaring contradiction, which may come to be thought of, you know, a seminal moment in either the realisation of the end of his power or the real end of his power. And so I think that is one to watch. And as far as I think Michael is right, you know, when he's talking about, you know, how these other outlets are propaganda ones. But I think the interesting thing is, I mean, I think to some extent they probably can't believe their luck and the perceived influence which they now have. Because 12 months ago, it was still, you know, still quite considered an eccentric view that Mr. Trump would become president. It was becoming realer and realer. But those wise heads, you know, who really knew what was going to happen said, no, this can't happen. It has. And so I suspect some of those outlets just can't believe that it's happened. And I think Michael's also right when he says they would find someone else. But would they find someone else who could become president of the United States? And therefore, one imagines their influence would decline accordingly.
Yeah, well that's true. And just one last thing about Fox is that it isn't so much about losers in terms of politically losing. Just remember, it still makes over $1 billion a year for the balance sheet of Murdoch's whatever company. It's not 20th. It's not Fox, is it?
News Corp.
It's News Corp. Yeah, it's News Corp. News, whatever it is anymore. So when your unit is depositing $1 billion on the boss, he's really not going to be too concerned about the editorial line. And he can, you know, as opposed to in this country, where it is possible that Ofcom might take a long look at the way in which Fox News is covering this story in America and ignoring it or running a set of you can't call them counterfactuals, you know, just a kind of counter propaganda, and say, well, we really can't allow that. You know, Sky News, which is owned in part by Murdoch, needs to be firewalled from total control of a man who's willing to allow this to happen at his media properties.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Michael Goldfarb and James Rogers. Coming up next, have we yet figured out exactly what Macronism is?
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are James Rogers and Michael Goldfarb. Now, in his first interview with foreign media since becoming France's Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe offered an interesting take on the underlying principles to what is becoming to be known as Macronism, that being the ideology underpinning President Emmanuel Macron's political vision, such as we mere mortals are able to comprehend it. When asked by the Financial Times if a flexible labour market, tax cuts for businesses and scaling down public spending were all taken from the political right, the Prime Minister laughed and said, yes, what did you expect? Michael, first of all, it's not remotely surprising, really, is it, that someone of Macron's professional background should have some fairly conservative views?
Not at all. I mean, the amazing thing...
Listeners, unfortunately, were unable to see the magnificently French gesture with which you accompanied that response.
I know. it would be really naff for me to try and answer you in French now. No... Plus, if my wife...
I wouldn't understand you if you did.
If my wife was as... If, is much older than his wife is, my wife would be over 100 years old. I just thought I'd throw that into the conversation. Look, Macron comes from the same class that has produced French leadership as long as I've been a sentient human being. His trick was, one, being younger, two, detaching himself from the party apparatuses from which his class selects its leadership. Yeah, so every French prime minister for 25 years has spoken about doing precisely these things, going to loosen up the jobs market, be nice to lower taxes because the tax rate is what, I mean, it's all connected. You know, you keep 10% of your population unemployed and tax your companies heavily to make sure the social benefits cover them, all of that. So yes, of course. He worked where? At Rothschild Bank. He was the economics minister of a socialist prime minister who was trying to do precisely these things. And so, of course, this is what he's going to try and do.
James, did he pull a bit of a fast one? Because, of course, he ran as a pragmatist centrist, as a sort of antidote to the populism sweeping Europe and causing a certain amount of unease among folk who like to think of themselves also as pragmatist centrist. Did he actually just run basically a populist campaign without anyone really noticing?
I think he ran as an unknown quantity to quite an extent. I mean, he has had some political experience, but a fairly limited amount. He's relatively young for a head of state, only 39 when he was elected. I think we have to remember the candidate against whom he was pitted in the final round. He was pitted against somebody from the Front National, the extreme right after all. So I think, to an extent, there were a lot of people, I mean, and this has got precedent in recent French political history, when Jean-Marie Le Pen, Marine Le Pen's father, stood in 2002. I was there covering the election, actually. There were a lot of French people who voted for him in the second round with extreme reluctance. There was a degree of that this time round, too. You saw people deciding they weren't going to vote until after 5 o'clock in the afternoon, that being a sign of the protest against the choice or lack of it, as they saw it, of candidates on offer. So I think he ran to some extent as an unknown quantity, but his opponent was very much, I think most people felt, a known quantity, and one which the majority of French people decided, after all, that they didn't want. And I think there are very serious challenges ahead. I mean, Michael is right to say that, you know, a lot of French presidents over the last 20 years have proposed these sorts of reforms. They have proved impossible so far to introduce.
There is another fairly old school, I think you could put it, aspect to what we have seen of President Macron so far, Michael, which is his presentation. He comes across, he's been very keen to sort of be photographed with the military, to be sort of have his picture taken in somewhat grand circumstances. There's been a lot of, you know, gold furniture and big flags and stuff like that. But what's interesting is that 66% of French people approve of his communication style. Has he located something about the presidency that people thought had been missing under François Hollande in particular?
Well, there it is, François Hollande in particular. I mean, my memory is that when Sarkozy took over in 2007, he too and was keen to be seen, if among other reasons, because he's so short, and wanted to be seen with big equestrian guards and so on to improve his stature. But, you know, part of French culture is this idea of gloire, glory. They do, you know, no matter, I'm sure that even if you found a black balaclavaed kid throwing a Molotov cocktail on the 14th of July at Donald Trump, possibly, or at his motorcade, and then took him aside for a coffee, he would speak of France's mission and how important it was. It is just something about the French. I don't know, maybe James could carry on with this. I mean, it's so different than the Brits, I mean, the English in particular, who have made self-deprecation, maybe less so in the age of Brexit, but, you know, self-deprecation was always part of the country here. You know?
Indeed.
And when you go across the channel, suddenly every building, all of the mayories, the town halls, they're all grand. Everything is grand. So I think, actually, Macron is just being very French.
Well, you raise there Bastille Day. And of course, Donald Trump has had a knack of making literally everything about himself. But he will be, as plans currently are, he will be back in Europe as soon as this Friday, being hosted by Emmanuel Macron. There is to be a grand military parade. Again, what is Macron seeking to do there? He knows that Trump is not terrifically popular in France or in Europe or indeed really anywhere outside the bits of America that he's popular in. Why does Macron want to do this?
I suspect he wants to show that he's got a working relationship with a very powerful man, however popular he may or may not be. I mean, we're talking about comparisons with the UK. I mean, we haven't done terribly well on that with under our current Prime Minister, I don't think. Theresa May was very quick to try to build this this bond with Donald Trump. It doesn't really seem to have delivered. Maybe Monsieur Macron's going to prove he can have another go at it. I mean, and certainly inviting him for Bastille Day is not exactly, you know, having a small meeting somewhere on the coast. It's, you know, It's as big a deal as there is. It's pretty much as big a deal as there is. A national holiday with, as you say, a huge military parade down the Champs-Élysées.
Okay, well, we have that to look forward to, and we should probably pause to spare some sympathy for the White House briefing officer who has to explain to Donald Trump what Bastille Day is. But finally, we should look at New York Mayor Bill de Blasio. As he departed for the G20 in Hamburg last week, the cries from the shouty side of his city's press were unanimous. "Don't come back," said the New York Post. "Mayor phones it in," was how the Daily News put it, before the Post charmingly headlined his return with "Deutsch Bag." Which, though obviously unforgivable, is admittedly ingenious. Bill de Blasio defended his overseas trip, saying it was important that international leaders know that Donald Trump is not representative of the United States' overall political will, but many officials saw it as a grandiose reach for an office beyond that of the city's mayor. Michael, is there any... Well, I mean, if you're the mayor of New York City in particular, you are actually kind of a bigger deal than a lot of actual national leaders, are you not? Is there any reason why Bill de Blasio should not pitch up at the G20?
Well, no. That's a very serious point. I mean, more people live in cities now than live in the countryside. I think as a unit of political power, I think one of the stories of the century that's unfolding is that cities are going to become real, city governments are actually going to become even more important than they are. So, I mean, just intellectually, if the mayor of New York and the wants to go to Hamburg to look at, to say, look, one, we're not going to agree to follow our president. We will maintain our standards on emissions. Two, Hamburg is a major city in globalization. It's a massive port. If he goes to Sydney, if Bill de Blasio goes to Sydney, no problems there. He'll have a good time in Sydney, won't he?
I would think so.
But the other thing, of course, is that politics is still local. And in New York, the two tabloids, you know, he's got a lot of domestic politics he's been neglecting and is accused of neglecting related to, you know, how the police force, which has never liked him, is being neglected. The city's schools are still in some trouble. He's not delivered on campaign promises. So all politics are local. The local tabloids are beating up on him. But I think that is a trend of the future. I think mayors are going to end up having to do it themselves. I mean, Sadiq Khan is arguably the most important labor, even for the future, he is the most important Labour politician.
Just looking at it as a tabloid story, though, James, with your journalistic hat on, I mean, this is a reliable trope of newspapers, beat up on the leader who is out of the city when something happens. And if it's New York City, something's always going to happen. Does this still fly, this one, though? Because, I mean, it's not... I'm sure Bill de Blasio owns a mobile telephone. If something terrible happens, he can be contacted. Does this still have traction, this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a reasonable go for the tabloids to try, but I don't think it's that convincing. I mean, I think Michael's listed a number of reasons why I think this is absolutely fair enough. Cities are increasingly important. You know, you can look right across the West. Cities have got distinct political systems and increasingly distinct political beliefs, if we look at London and the seaboards of the United States, and distinct economies. So I think it's fair enough, but it's also, you know, never let the facts get in the way of a good story, and if you've got a good lead, let's go for it.
And on that uplifting lesson for any of our regular subscribers who work in the field of journalism. That brings us to the end of today's show. James Rogers and Michael Goldfarb, thanks for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maya Hegard. Our studio manager was Josh Prince. Music next at 1900, it's The Entrepreneurs, followed by The Cinema Show. And there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.